pockets, tight holes. The politicians bouncing down the road, everybody's wishing for no more corruption and dysfunction. It's gonna take divine intervention.
God bless out there in Alamo Mosa. How? Bamani Hara, Sadiq, Yasalom. This is Chapman High McHenry, your host for the Founders Show, and your spin Gary Baba of the Republic. And we welcome you to the show today. I say we, I mean Christopher Tidmore, the journalist of New Orleans, par excellent. There's a lot going on, as you know, the Crimea. Down here in Louisiana, there's a heated debate going over our educational system dealing with Common Core. And then, and strangely enough, the Crimea situation is bringing in a remarkable, if you will, secondary and tertiary effect on our oil industry in the United States and certainly down here in Louisiana. And so, Christopher, what you thinking about all this crazy stuff?
Well, you know, as some of you might have noted, and as we're taping this show on Thursday for WRNO, we're on live from 8 to 9 p.m. on WRNO, and of course, one of the things that comes through as we've taped it, the Crimea has declared its independence from the Ukraine and said the Crimean parliament and signals that it wants to be part of Russia. That creates a bit of a political ne'er-do-well for itself because, and for the United States, because using Kosovo as an example, we've already said that parts of countries can declare independence. But what's interesting about the whole situation in Ukraine is Russia's flexing its muscles saying, you have to accept the Crimea declaring its independence because we'll cut off your liquid natural gas heating. This is, after all, Europe, and it's far away from the jet stream. The Ukraine, which literally means, people forget, the Ukraine is not a national name. It means the borderlands in all the Slavic languages. And it's a place that I often think of as being very similar to where the Scots-Irish came from in Ulster and the Irish borderlands. And that's what, not surprisingly, the Cossacks came from that same place. They were sort of independent. They were hard to hold down. They didn't follow authority. Well, the Ukraine is dependent upon to keep their houses warm, to run their industry, natural gas pumped in by the Russian natural gas firm Gazprom. It's 60% of Ukraine's natural gas resources. And Ukraine, that pipeline that goes to Ukraine provides something like 40 to 50% of Europe's natural gas. So all those German households that get heated in winter, it's Russian heat. Why is that? Because it's been illegal up until really the current day since the 1970s for the United States to export natural gas. And now the situation is raising it to fever pitch. Last year, officially, for the first time since the 1970s, we were able to produce 97% of our domestic energy usage by natural gas and petroleum drilled in the United States. You heard what I said, Hi. 97%.
My goodness. That makes me think of what's happening down here in Louisiana. And also, I want to add this to it, Christopher. I hope you can tell us, I believe you traveled through the Crimea and through the Ukraine a couple years ago, and I'd love to hear what it was like, what you got out of it, first-hand account. But before we do that, let me just quickly tell y'all that you may not know it, but Louisiana is sitting on the honeypot of oil and gas for the whole world. I mean, that's pretty hard to believe, but let me tell you how it's happening. They have discovered a new trend called the Tuscaloosa shale trend, shale oil trend. It runs, it's kind of like a boomerang. It starts up in North Louisiana, shoots on down into St. Tammany Parish, southeast Louisiana, but north of the lake, and then shoots up into the Mississippi, like central Mississippi. And it is actually, they've tested it out now to be sitting on 17.5% of all of the oil in America. That's including Alaska. That's including all of the huge, the Bakken. It's more than the Bakken Fine has. It's astounding. So we're very, very excited about it down here in Louisiana. And I'm sure people who own land over in St. Tammany Parish in the right place, they're pretty excited about it too. And so this is going to put pressure all the more to continue to develop our oil industry here in America. And I know that Christopher has more to, he's got very good stuff here. But hear what he has to say now.
If we're able to export this natural gas, and that's been the issue about all this. Since the 1970s, when this export ban was passed during the Carter administration, it has been illegal to export natural gas or petroleum from the U.S. There are without a presidential waiver. There were 20 requests last year for liquid natural gas tankers to be able to export. Only 6 were approved. So some limited to our free trade partners was allowed, but not very much. The Obama administration has been heeding the calls of environmentalists who said this will raise the price of energy for domestic U.S. consumers, which is a bit ridiculous if you look at how petroleum works. All over the world, the price is set by an international market. Instead, what was happening in the Tuscaloosa Shale, that great arc that some people are calling us Saudi America because of it, is the fact that they were saying, well, when we hit 100%, we're at 97 now, there's not going to be a lot of incentive to drill more because you just can't do anything with it. You can't do anything outside this market. Now members of Congress are starting to say, because of the Ukrainian situation, we've got to move as a country to not only outfit Ukraine with energy, but all of Europe. Otherwise, they will be under the heel of Vladimir Putin and the natural gas and oil that comes from it. And this gives us the possibility of not only extending U.S. soft power, call it energy power, all over Europe and keeping it in our sphere, keeping the Ukraine happy, but an interesting side effect of all of this, to give you an idea of not only how many jobs and how much economic impact it would have, but what it would do to America's position in the world. We've had a little thing in the United States since the 1970s called a trade deficit. That means simply that we actually bought more than we sold from the rest of the world. So American wealth went out. That's not necessarily all bad, but if you have to have a choice between a trade surplus and a trade deficit, you want a trade surplus. If we were to allow just to export liquid natural gas to Europe and the commodities that the Russians have, we would have a U.S. trade surplus year after year just exporting to Europe and to the Ukraine. Imagine what that would do for our economy for the first time in decades. And imagine what it does to our role in the world. And it's all about the Obama administration. Now, the Obama administration moved. 2 weeks ago, it wouldn't do anything for Ukraine. As of Thursday, the U.S. Congress, at its behest, passed loan guarantees for the Ukrainian government so they can get money to keep operating for the new government in Ukraine. However, there is pressure now from Democrats and Republicans, actually led by Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, who've said, you need to do this now. Eliminate all export bans. And there are some on the left of the Democratic Party who think this is an awful idea, but Republicans are going to be putting pressure on the president along with Democrats to do this, saying, very simply, do you want Ukraine to fall into Vladimir Putin's hands? You know, we had a joke here in Louisiana. It was called a freezing rain, R-E-I-G-N, as Rex went down the St. Charles Avenue in a freezing cold. He had a freezing rain as king of carnival. Well, right now, we have another freezing rain coming down. That's Vladimir Putin and the former trying to exude Russian will over the former republics of the Soviet Union. Crimea is probably gone. It's a limited connection to Ukraine, and frankly, he builds a bridge to the Russian Federation. It's a small strait. It's closer, honestly, than the two sides of the Mississippi River. It's not a big deal. He can connect the Crimea from the other side to the Russian Federation. What matters now is the other one-third of the Ukraine that is Russian majority and letting that slip out of the West fingers. And ultimately, holding Vladimir Putin's neo-czarist imperialism down in a way that helps the U.S. economy.
Fascinating. You know, another perhaps reason for this whole Ukrainian deal is, and this is just coming out, they have discovered a row of pyramids running across the Crimea, about a dozen of them, and they have discovered them in the Jurassic level, the Jurassic strata where the dinosaurs were, which is creating a real upheaval in the world of geology and evolution and everything. Because it's believed that there was no way that there could be any kind of human life at that time on planet Earth. They're even discovering skeletons that are humanoid in appearance, but not real human skeletons. And this is one reason that, you know, the Russians have for a long time now, they've had just like the United States says, they've had very serious research groups and programs going on, trying to dig into the UFOs and the ET stuff. And so one big thing is Putin coming down there to develop greater contact with UFOs? I don't know. It seems kind of really ridiculous and bizarre, but you cannot deny the fact. I've seen the pictures. I've read the reports on it. There are pyramids. It's not made by animals. These are man-made human pyramids. And now if you're a biblical student, you would say, well, that's – that was part of the antediluvian civilization that had become so corrupted that God had to wipe them all out. And so hence they were all together at the same time. And that's why they would have been found in the Jurassic strata period. All right. Well, Christopher, again, this is very, very exciting. If you have any memories, anything you can tell us about when you were there, I'd love to find out.
It was interesting. I ended up, what strikes me about the Ukraine was I traveled across Russia, actually, with a couple from Lvov, which is the western area of the Ukraine, named Vlana and Dima. In fact, it was interesting. We were in Kazakhstan, and we picked them up on the side of the road. They were hitchhiking. They were trying to go across Asia, and they joined us. And they gave me a good insight onto how the average person in the Ukrainian sectors of Ukraine, those people that speak Ukrainian, which is a distinct language from Russian, feel. And basically, they feel a connection with Europe. But that's not so surprising. If you look at a map of the Ukraine and you look at the Ukrainian sectors of the Ukraine, it's the exact map of what was called the Kingdom of Galicia and Ruthenia in the 17th, 18th century. It was part of the Lithuanian-Polish Commonwealth. It was literally Western. It's also majority Roman Catholic. The Ukrainians themselves are feeling the West, not out of any sort of sentimental viewpoint, but for the most part because they never really were Russian. Now, the Russians look at Kiev as the root of their civilization. They think it's their Jerusalem. And I mean that term not hypothetically. It's where St. Cyril and had his first conversions to Russian Orthodoxy. It's where the first Khazars came in, and it was destroyed in the 13th century. The Russians moved north. And so what we have here is a city that's occupied by different people. Of course, they've been there for about 800 years, so, I mean, it depends upon your definition of difference. Where, if you noted a little while ago, Hi, the complication for the United States and the Obama administration, when the Crimean Parliament today, the Crimean Provincial Parliament of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea, that's a mouthful, actually voted to join Russia, and we're taping this on Thursday, folks, they said, we have a right of national self-determination. And for any Southerner, there's a little romance in that term. But the problem is the United States actually confirmed that term over something Russia hated, Kosovo. You remember Kosovo? We said Kosovo should have their own independence away from Serbia. The Serbians and the Russians have always been very close. World War I started over Russia supporting Serbia. When we said Kosovo could declare its independence, even though it was an integral part of another nation, we removed any intellectual justification for opposing Crimea from doing the same. Because I've got news for you. Unlike the rest of Ukraine, that's what that conversation I was telling you with that couple had, and the time I've spent in and around the area, the fact of the matter is, in the Russian sectors of Ukraine, they view themselves as Russian. And I have no doubt, believe it or not, that in the Crimea at least, if there was a free and fair vote, they would vote to join Russia. So it puts us in a bit of a trick bag, and nobody seems to be talking about this in the media. How do you stop people who genuinely want to join their national, what is the German word? Umschloss, I think it's the same culture of a nation state. I got that wrong, folks, so forgive me. How do you stop that? The answer is you can't. At this point, we've got to be realistic. What can the United States do? One is what we talked about with natural gas, and immediately the U.S. Congress could authorize this. But the second one that we haven't talked about is what's called the Mariinsky Act. This was a Soviet-era law that was passed by the United States that said any illegal activity by Soviet Union or its successor states, which Russian Federation is, we have the right to be able to impose sanctions and freeze bank accounts. Now, Vladimir Putin can act like a czar because the modern boyar class of Russia, the lords of Russia, are the oligarchs. And the oligarchs have billions of dollars in U.S. and British and French banks. We could seize every dollar of it. We could shut off Gazprom's pumping. We could put Russia into a financial crisis, the likes of which we couldn't have pretended to during the Cold War. And so far, nobody's done that. Because the Russians will go to war. We're afraid the Russians will just march their troops straight all the way to Kiev. That this will be Hungary 1956 or Czechoslovakia 1968. And it's possible. The funny thing about this situation with Ukraine is we may be closer to war with Russia at any point than we were during the communist period.
Yes, I do believe that this could be the beginning of World War III, and the Bible predicted it would happen just like this. I'm hoping it's not going to be, but it could be. And by the way, speaking about Obama doing the right thing, which would mean to open up trade, to boost our oil industry and give us an advantage, and to get, which would be getting tough with Russia, for all of that, does he have the kahunas, as they say, or does he have the will, the strength to do it, or is he just going to continue to be a wuss of a president, a dancing through the tulips president, who has shown repeatedly that he constantly lets Putin get over on him, that he doesn't have the backbone or the strength or the courage to face a man like Putin. So is he going to? These are all great ideas, and these would really work. But we have a president who has shown repeatedly that he's not a strong president. So will he have the strength to do it? Now, some people say, well, he got Osama bin Laden. Well, all he did was cash in on what Bush had done for. Bush did 99% of the heavy lifting and all that. He just cashed in on all that hard work during the Bush years, which was good for his political advantage. And he almost didn't push the button on Osama bin Laden. He almost held on. He held on that to the very end. they say, well, he's taking a lot of the al-Qaeda with drones, and that's true. But again, remember, that was Bush's program. He just continued to let it go. In fact, he's just about ditto everything Bush has done under the Bush years. So I don't know that he has the gumption to come up with anything new or original that demonstrates that he really does have strength, and he's not afraid to face a man like Putin. He's demonstrated that he's the biggest playboy president we've ever had. If y'all heard my show yesterday, you heard me play the pirate song by Ray Stevens, where they have the tough black beard, the pirate, tough guy, and then he has his cousin is this little wimpy pirate who wants to dance and sing and play. And I use that. It wasn't done as a political parody, but I used it as one yesterday because it was a perfect picture of what's going on with our president versus the tough leadership of other countries around the world. Thank you, Christopher.
But all right, I agree with you. I'm the one who brought up the export potential. But ultimately, in Obama's case, what can you do, Hi? When it comes right down to it, if you're Barack Obama, Russia does have a nuclear stockpile. You can only push him so far. So what exactly are the options here? And honestly, no, there's no doubt whatsoever that when it's come to Syria, when it's come to Iran, and it's come to Russia, he hasn't acted. But I'm going to make a point. When part of the Syria vote failed because of Republicans who didn't want to get involved. And Syria, and that's the part that people are forgetting. Syria's an integral part of this. Putin thought he could act in Crimea because we did nothing about Bashar Assad in Syria, who's his surrogate. It's Russian arms that keep Bashar Assad alive. It's been Russian logistical help. It's Russian money for a naval base they have in Syria. When it comes to Iran, we've done nothing. Vladimir Putin went to Iran in July of last year and solidified the Moscow-Tehran access. So for Obama, at this point, it may be too little too late. But his options are actually relatively limited if he's not willing to go so far.
Well, again, we had a president who ended the Cold War. He was a tough guy. He was known as a cowboy. And they feared him. And when they saw Reagan shut down the air controllers, they knew he wasn't playing around. He would follow through with his threats or red lines or whatever, not continue to back up the red line. And so Putin's looking at a guy who's repeatedly shown that he's weak. Bush did play economics against the Russians. He opened up things that had never been opened up before. He leaned on other countries, like he went to South Africa, got them to start outproducing the Russians in gold and precious and strategic metals, which was a trump card the Russians had. He, of course, outspent them in the Star Wars program, which, of course, was never going to totally work, but the Russians didn't really know it. And they tried to keep up with us on that and could not and finally had to fold. So do we have a president who's willing to do that? It's nowhere nearly as bad as it was back then. We had a serious Cold War issue back then. Sure, the Russians have nukes, and we have nukes, but they're not. It's not anywhere near at the danger level that it was under the Reagan years. Will this president even have half the backbone of Ronald Reagan to stop this thing?
I think it's interesting you didn't say George W. Bush. You said he looked into Vladimir Putin's soul and saw a good man. I mean, come on. This has been a bipartisan thing. And I remember John McCain. He says, I looked in his soul. I saw three letters, KGB.
Well, that's right. And but Bush was probably just being diplomatic, you know, trying to win points on the diplomatic scale, I guess. By the way, Bush was not, and I know this now, as y'all know, my background is Army intelligence, military intelligence, U.S. Army Special Forces. And one thing I learned in SF and in military intelligence is that, and I've had this confirmed by much higher level people than myself also, there is an intel grapevine. And that is that Bush was really, George W. Bush was really feared by nations all around the world. They knew he was a cowboy and he would come in blazing if we were challenged, that he followed through on his red lines. He did not wimp out on them. So Bush was a strong guy. And I think the looking into his eyes deal, I mean, that was
he's getting all choked up about George W. Bush, folks. The slaves. I remember Vladimir Putin wore this big cross, and Vladimir Putin's is about as much as a Christian as I am an automobile, just because I stand occasionally in a garage. But the fact of the matter is, speaking of Bush, before we go to the break, because we're coming up on a break, ladies and gentlemen, it's 27 minutes after the hour. And one of the things that is interesting about in Bush news is Barbara Bush had been saying for the longest time, Jeb Bush shouldn't run for president. Too many Bushes. Well, her grandson, Jeb Bush is her great grandson. Her grandson, Jeb Bush's son, George P. Bush. I know this gets confusing. Jeb Bush's son is George Prescott Bush, who lives in Texas, not Florida. He just won the Republican primary for Texas Land Commissioner, and that will likely mean he'll become the next Texas Land Commissioner, which is a very powerful post in Texas. And it's usually considered a stepping stone to the governorship. So he could be one of the youngest governors in Texas history in another 4 to 8 years. His father has been making noises about a run against Hillary Clinton. Barbara Bush came out today and said, you know, maybe I was wrong. Maybe Jeb Bush, it's not, there aren't too many Bushes. Maybe Jeb Bush, maybe my son Jeb would make a good candidate for president. So we might have another Bush-Clinton face-off when it comes through, coming to the elections. You know, I thought we were past this. You know, we're going to go Bush-Clinton, Bush-Clinton, Bush-Clinton. You end up with Chelsea versus George P. And enough with the dynasties. As she quotes, she says, well, I was told in the 1700s there were basically three political families in America, so I guess it's not too many.
Wow. What's happening to this country with dynasties being built now by special families? I don't like it. It doesn't sound like something that our founding fathers ever wanted for us. And as you know, folks, this is the Founders Show. And the reason we call it that, we base it upon the concepts of the founding fathers, the founding documents, Constitution, Declaration of Independence, English common law, and down here in Louisiana, the Napoleonic Code. All of the aforementioned canons rest upon the greatest canon of all, Holy Writ, the Word of God. And so that's how we attempt to see our world today, through the magnifying glass, the crystal prism of the Bible, with the same biblical mindset and biblical worldview. We apply it to our world today for our observations, our evaluations, decisions, and finally our actions. So folks, thanks so much for tuning in. It is time now to hear about a wonderful ministry, Lamb Ministries, a ministry that was founded here in New Orleans by myself and my wife and several others. We're an inner city ministry working with inner city kids, and now also the business community. And if you'd like to find out more about us, go to our website, lambnola.com, lambnola.com, and check us out. I promise you, folks, you'll love it. You'll enjoy it. It's a great, great ministry to get with which to get involved if you want to help the poor, the urban poor, and the needy. And we appreciate all of your interest. Thank you so much.
And folks, we'll be back after these important messages. Stay tuned for more with Hi McHenry and Christopher Tidmore here on The Founders Show and thefoundersshow.net.
And we're joined by Bert Lamont of Bert's Christian Auto Repair. And Bert, welcome to the program this morning.
Well, good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
And one of the things that people need to be paying attention to is the condition of their cars. You know, so many problems can be averted cheaply if somebody just takes a little prevention, and that's what you specialize in.
That's right. You know, that's why periodically stopping by my shop, let me check lights, fluids, air pressure in the tires, belts and hoses, These minor little things. Change your oil on time. It's cheap. It's the most important service you can do on your car.
Which you do at your place.
We do it all. That's right. We do it all. But these little things that you know, most people say, God, I don't have the time for it. I don't have the time for it, you know. Well, guess what? If you take the time for it, you'd be surprised how reliable your car can become.
Now, of course, that's Burt's Complete Auto Repair, 734-1612. Give me, it's a 49 David Drive in Metairie, right off. And you've got a right look. If somebody's looking for your shop, you got something special to greet them.
That's right. There's a black fishing boat sticking out the front of the building near the roof. It's unique. No, it's not a car, but I guarantee you a lot of you have seen it, and it'll help you to find me.
One block off of Airline, Burt's Complete Auto Repair for all of your auto repair needs. Folks, check him out. Big or small, yours truly, Christopher Tidmore, can testify. Burt has done everything on my cars, from changing the oil to changing the engine and everything in between, ladies and gentlemen, and my cars run like a top. Burt's Complete Auto Repair, 409 David Drive in Metairie, right one block off of Airline. Telephone number 504-734-1612.
And coming up, folks, of course, we've got the legislative session coming through. Elections in New Orleans and elsewhere here on the vote. We also want to today's show is brought to you by Villery's Florist with a special tulips offer, $7.99 for a dozen tulips.
And here's Villery's Florist own Roger Villery to talk about it.
Now, Villery's Florist has been in business since 1969. We started here in Metairie, Louisiana, and we have stores now on both the North Shore and the South Shore. Besides just a regular walk-in service, which we have a very good selection, we have large refrigerators full of cut flowers, but we also offer delivery service. Oh, I enjoy people getting flowers and making them happy. When I see the smiles on their face because we did a good job, I mean, that's really a great reward for me. We keep a large variety of cut flowers. We have a number of floral artists on staff that we can make arrangements. Villery's Florist is known for the selection of quality fresh flowers. We have one of the best selection of fresh cut flowers in the state of Louisiana and really in the country on a regular daily basis.
And folks, you can check them out on the web at www.villeriesflorist.com or call them at 1-800-VILLERE.
The path to restoring our republic was laid down by our founding fathers. The principles of freedom, liberty, personal responsibility, and limited government are conservative ideals we will never abandon.
America is listening.
Grassroots, common sense, conservative talk radio. It's on the internet. Tune in now. Red State Talk Radio, featuring some of the most popular internet talk show hosts in America today. Are you listening? RedStateTalkRadio.com.
Bud's Broiler, 500 City Park Avenue, home to the best charbroil hamburger in New Orleans. Hi, this is Chris Champagne. Every American city has its iconic burger. In New Orleans, that's Bud's Broiler, 500 City Park Avenue. It's the burger that generations of Orleanians dream of when they yearn for a taste of home. Stop by the landmark at 500 City Park Avenue whenever the urge hits, because Bud's Broiler, 500 City Park Avenue, is open 24 hours. Bud's Broiler, 500 City Park Avenue, across from Delgado.
By the way, as you've listened to these tunes with which we open and close the show with Armand St. Martin, you might want to check him out. Folks, he is the jazz piano player of the South and the bard and minstrel of the Founders Show. Go to his website, PattyLeeRecords.com, spell PattyLeeRecords.com, and check out those golden melodies banged out on the ivory and ebony keys with the dance and digitals of Armand St. Martin, the jazz piano player of the South, and schedule a live event with Armand St. Martin. I promise you, folks, you will love his music. You will not be disappointed. Well, folks, it's time for us to get back into our regular show. And so, Christopher, what you thinking now?
The legislative session here is something that is not to be planned. It starts on March the 10th, goes to June the 2nd, and if they're there one more minute, they go to jail. Frankly, I think, it would be much better if they went to jail a little before June the 2nd, maybe as recently. But many issues will be brought up. For one thing, there is going to be a move to raise the minimum wage in Louisiana between $9 and $10. And I'm not giving a whole lot of time talking about that because that will last about nanoseconds before it is. But the Democratic Party has an aggressive agenda that they're trying to put out against the Republican majority that's for the most part opposed by it. And that includes not only raising the federal minimum wage to between $9 and $10 from the $7.25 an hour, but also what is going on in various other areas. However, a lot of the discussion is going to be on an issue that divides the two parties, and it's called Common Core. For those of you that don't know what this is, depending upon who you talk to, it's either an issue of education that allows the United States to have innocuous set of federal standards, or it's a federal takeover of education altogether, that the states are giving up their educational control. Led by Representative Cameron Henry of Old Jefferson and Old Metairie, there is a chance to appeal to repeal the Common Core standards. Meanwhile, the Executive Vice President, COO of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, will be pushing for higher standards under Common Core and what's going on with it. And the essence of what Common Core is interesting because it divides Republicans and Democrats. While you have Henry moving to repeal Common Core, you have the state senator of that district, Conrad Appel, defending Common Core as head of the Education Committee in the Senate. So who's right and who's wrong on Common Core? And honestly, Hi, I wasn't sure. I've heard a lot of wonderful people say Common Core was nothing. I've had others say it's the worst thing since the idea of eating nutria as part of gumbo. And this is what I came to the conclusion of, that Common Core is having some unintended side effects that allow it to be bad, even if it's good by itself. And this is the example I use. As some people know, I sit on the Churchill Society of New Orleans Board of Directors. And I'll put a little plug out there. The International Churchill Conference is coming to New Orleans the weekend of weekend of April 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. Winston Churchill's granddaughter and great-grandson will be attending and all this. But we put out an essay contest for the Churchill Society of New Orleans. You can find out more about that at churchillsocietyneworleans.com. And our essay contest comes out March the 10th, the first day of the legislative session. This is the last day to submit this. It's on Winston and this. Anyway, we've had some wonderful schools participate. One of those schools is the New Orleans Military and Maritime High School, an absolutely outstanding school in Algiers. And the English teacher has been wonderful, and she's gotten her students involved. And she said, this is so great, because we gave her readings on Winston Churchill. And she said, this is so great, because we're not allowed under Common Core to have fiction reading in our classes, so we'll read about Churchill. Now, if you have to make a choice, I'll say, okay, I can live with reading about Churchill. But I stopped, and I remember sitting there. It was two of our board members, Herschel Abbott, Ted Martin, and myself. And the three of us stopped and said, wait, what? This is an English class. You can't read fiction. No, we can't. Common Core can't. It says that we couldn't. I said, you mean, so how do you do Shakespeare? We don't. Mark Twain? We don't. And I went through. I subsequently brought this up with some Common Core advocates, including Senator Conrad Appel, and they said, that's ridiculous. Nowhere does it say you can't do fiction in Common Core. And they went back and forth, and he said, if you really read it, it's a blown out of proportion. But here's the thing that I get. Whether Common Core is not bad or whether it's good, the teachers in the rank and file, and I've subsequently talked to about a couple dozen, at least a dozen schools, because I deal with high schools on this essay contest, have all told me the same thing. We're afraid to teach fiction in English classes because Common Core may not allow it. That's terrifying. How do you learn without learning Shakespeare? How do you learn the beauties of the English language? How do you learn the essence of the literature of mankind and of the United States without reading Huckleberry Finn, without reading Herman Melville's Moby Dick, or reading we talked about Russia, reading Tolstoy's War and Peace? How do you understand our Judeo-Christian ethic when if you don't read Dante's Inferno or if you don't read the Iliad and the Odyssey? And that's what Common Core is doing, whether it intends it or not.
You're right, Christopher. And you did say the Iliad and the Odyssey, which actually came from Homer and actually a pagan source. But what a lot of people don't realize about the Iliad and the Odyssey, it had very solid biblical themes in it. And it was a moral code that was taught through a narrative form and through, in certain ways, fiction, I would guess. And it had a huge impact on the Mediterranean world. And for over 1,000 years, the great genius of the Mediterranean, they all studied the Iliad and the Odyssey, not just as a fun book to read, but as something that would direct their lives and build their philosophy of life. And they even memorized Homer. They didn't just read it, they memorized it. That's how important it was to them. But remember this, it had a biblical concept in its morals and teachings and whatnot. So it did have a pagan source, but still a biblical concept. And but the reason they don't want you to read fiction is fiction helps build a creative mind. They do not want that. They want a lot of lockstep and little Nazi, neo-Nazi, you know, Hitler youth, communist youth out there who only know how to push buttons. They're trying to build a technocracy of slave labor in this country. So, and, I mean, it sounds outrageous, and but that's what's happening. And that's exactly what the Nazis did. It's exactly what the communists did. That's why the preferred name of this or this system for me is Communist Core. Not Common Core, but Communist Core. And they've made America look like we're a bunch of wimps. They've made Reagan one of the greatest presidents, I believe one of the greatest presidents of the entire history of America, and I also believe the greatest president of the entire 20th century. I put him above FDR and any other really great presidents we had during that time. Reagan was a remarkable fellow. He's the one that really did end the Cold War. And it was his courage and his strength, his tremendous rhetoric. And yet they have Reagan in the Common Core textbooks as being a little wimpy guy who almost does nothing and who's dumb and stupid. And they take one speech he does that nobody ever heard, and they take just a few words out of it, out of context, to make him look like he really was a nobody. And that's his one speech. One of the most famous lines, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, is completely left out of it. And by the way, the hero of ending the Cold War was, guess who? The old KGB, iron-fisted in a silk glove, Gorbachev. He's the one who really ended the Cold War when he had no choice. Reagan backed him in against the wall. Wait, we do have a caller. Let's see who this caller is. And so we got our first caller for today. Yes, could you please identify yourself and state the purpose of your call? This is the Founder Show, and thanks so much for calling in.
Hey, this is State Representative Cameron Henry. Just going to chime in on some of the Common Core discussion.
Okay. Well, great. We can't wait to hear you. I'm here. You know, my co-host here is Christopher Tidmore. Chris Frank.
And, Cam, we were just complimenting the work that you've been doing on working and trying to clarify what this Common Core thing is. Basically, trying to stop a lot of these teachers who feel threatened by these Common Core standards and being able to teach. Share with us, if you would, what you're confronting, because it's not been an easy trek as you've stood up with some of these. Stood up basically against this.
Well, it's a unique group of individuals that have come out with their concerns on Common Core. You have parents who still have a lot of unanswered questions from the state that really can't answer the most simplest of questions. And then you have teachers concerned that just about the implementation and how poorly that was done. And, of course, teachers are, under this new system that we've created, are graded based on the children's performance as well as their own performance, which I'm not opposed to. It's more of we have to give them at least the opportunity to succeed. And when you throw something as complex as Common Core curriculum has become and a complete 360 on how these teachers actually were taught in college on how to perform these tasks, it makes it almost impossible for teachers to succeed. I mean, we're teaching math a completely different way than we were 5 years ago.
Representative Henry, one of the things that I wanted to bring up, it's not only putting them in a difficult spot, as you've noted in your conversations, a lot of them are I hate to use this term, but I don't know if there's a more appropriate one. They're scared. They don't know. It's not just that it's a different way. Our teachers are very good. It's that they're seeing what are some of the fundamentals of what they were taught to teach, of how students learn, are completely being undermined. And I think where this gets to it, everybody wants, Representative Henry, a good school system, both in Louisiana and nationally. But it seems like we're abandoning the concept of local control completely and the idea that states and local communities determine their educational priorities. That used to be a conservative idea. When did this stop being a conservative idea? Because I know this has pitted you against some of your fellow Republicans.
Well, and there are a few Republicans that have come out 100% in favor of Common Core. A lot of them have taken the stance of they just don't know enough yet, and they want to see what comes out of the legislature. But, I mean, you're correct. We used to have local control, and that's one of the greatest falsehoods of Common Core. They say they give locals the control, and I think St. Tammany Parish is a perfect example of the locals have control. They don't want to be involved in Common Core, yet they're stuck with Common Core. So I think it's quite the opposite. I think parishes, the locals have a lot of, have less control. Perfectly honest with you, they don't have any control under this situation. But we're going to work with all the parties during session, and I think we're going to come up with something that parents are comfortable with, that teachers are comfortable with, and that still keeps our education system moving forward. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what the parents want, and that's what the teachers want, and we want to give them all the tools necessary to do that.
Yeah, thank you so much. You're absolutely right. And I have a question for you, Cameron, and I don't know how accurate this is, but I've been getting information that is telling me that Conrad Appel, of course, a Republican who's a Common Core fanatic, 100% behind it, has been the most driving force, I believe, in the legislature for it.
I think Conrad believes in Common Core for certain reasons. He and I just disagree. And it seems there are a lot of people in his district that disagree with him as well. But
Cameron, to come on the air to answer his view of Common Core, but you can honestly support this. There are plenty of conservatives who do and think that this is national standards. It started in the Bush administration. It does not do this. And that's one thing that a lot of people are missing. Interesting part of this whole debate, Cameron, is there are a lot of conservatives and Tea Party members who are against Common Core, and they're actually driving forces with some rather left-wing people and a lot of African-Americans who are members of the legislature who don't like this very much either, opposing the Obama administration. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, I think to say that it's the Obama administration, I mean, everyone, I think the feds at all levels have had a hand in Common Core. I think some of the members see how this is affecting the teachers, and of course, how it's affecting the students. And some of the students, not saying they can't perform at this level. Number one, a lot of them are just having difficulty with it. And when the children suffers, the teacher suffers, and that falls back on the legislature. When the teachers come to us and say, "Look, why are we doing this? Tell me why this is proven to be effective," and it goes back to the most basic questions I've asked John White and the administration. Hey, has increased rigor ever improved test scores? Tell me where this particular Common Core has increased test scores anywhere.
Well, and Cameron, Representative Henry, thank you so much for helping clarify that thing with Appel. But this is another point I'd like to make, and I believe I'm certain that I'm correct on this, that Common Core is not a new thing, and it didn't just start under the Bush administration. This goes back into the, I guess it was the late 70s, when a new educational program the left came up with that they literally called dumbing down because they wanted to make everybody equal, which meant they were going to get the smart kids to on the same level as the dumb kids. And so they literally called it dumbing down education. And they would do everything in groups, and the dumb guys could slide on the guys who were doing their homework. And it was a nightmare. It failed. So then they changed the name to outcome-based. And that they've had several name changes. It's the same concept. It just keeps getting rehashed under a new name. Is that correct?
Well, I think some parts of that have articulated down, you know, from the 70s to kind of making education a cookie cutter one system fits all. And I think you tell any teacher on the planet, they will know and they understand that every child in their classroom is different, and each child learns a different way, and you have to treat them that way, and you have to have that ability. And over the years, we've tried to, the government has tried to find a perfect way to educate children. And it doesn't exist. That's the hard part. There is no magic, what they call the silver bullet. It doesn't exist. You have to give teachers the option and the motivation and let them work. This is another attempt, I think, probably the worst one yet. But at the end of the day, I think everyone's going to come around to something that works.
State Representative Cameron Henry is joining us, and he's been very kind to join us on the fly. It's 49 minutes after the hour here on the Founders Show, foundersshow.net, for our live broadcast on WSLA on Thursday, and our rerun, of course, on WRNO from 8 to 9 p.m. on 99.5. And Cam, before we let you go, because I know you've got a fundraiser that you're attending, and I want to get your view on that particular race in just a second. What other issues should our audience be paying attention to in this legislative session that starts on the 10th?
I think that a significant issue will be the budget. The administration has put together another budget with one-time money for paying reoccurring expenses. They assume bills will pass other pieces of legislation to fund higher ed, which is ridiculous. It's just the budget, again, is another poor document that you will see a tremendous amount of input from legislatures, and just as much as we did last year, if not more, to try to get us on some sound footing. And I think you're going to see a lot dealing with the lawsuits, the levy lawsuits and the parish lawsuits against the oil companies. I think those are the three main issues you're going to see this session.
Those legacy lawsuits are becoming an issue of framing up, where you've got industry groups and the Louisiana Chemical Association facing off against environmental groups saying that the industry is not paying enough to repair. When they build canals and they build pipelines to the wetlands, they're not doing enough to repair those wetlands. Chemical groups are saying Louisiana is on the verge of an economic boom, and the fact is we could be chasing out these oil industries by allowing these legacy lawsuits that of things that are 20, 30 years old from continuing. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, it was a battle last year. I think it'll be continued. It'll be a continuous battle. I mean, obviously, there's some issues that we have to address. The parish lawsuits are the most recent, where, you know, the parish is suing 97 oil companies. Does that send a good message to business that a parish can sue 97 companies? Of course not. Do we believe that at some point in time the land needs to be fixed and addressed, chemicals need to be cleaned up, the coast needs to be repaired? Absolutely. Those are easy questions, and everybody has the same answer. It's how you do it and who is held liable for it. Those are the parts that you battle with. You have the trial lawyers on one side. How much money should they receive that's pulled from the coast on this? You have the landowners and the environmental groups against the chemical association. It is an endless battle where you try to come up with something that, as I like to say, where none of the interested parties are happy, and that usually means you've done something good. You don't want anyone to come out thinking that they've won. You want all parties to be a little upset about the outcome, and that means you've at that time usually have a pretty good piece of legislation that will actually do something. I don't think that will be solved this session or next session. I think that will be something you see every session.
Thank you so much, Representative Henry. And I think Christopher has one more thing he wants to say.
I have to ask you a little political thing, since you're a pretty good political prognosticator. I know after this show finishes taping, you're going to attend a fundraiser on the coroner's race for Dr. Jeffrey Rouse. Now, that's an interesting contest, because you've got Dr. Dwight McKenna, who almost won it in the first, running against Dr. Rouse, who himself has got pretty much every endorsement in the race from almost every organization in the lion's share of the money. But his opponent did get a longtime critic of Frank Minyard, the former coroner, Rouse's boss, did get 48% of the vote in the primary. Is this going to be a tight race? What are your thoughts on this? I know you're heading over to Rouse in the Park, where pretty much everybody, including Mayor Landrieu on down, Republicans and Democrats, are going to be out for Jeffrey Rouse as we go into the final week, with the election, of course, folks, on March the 15th.
There's no doubt with the percentages, it's going to be a close, you know, 1 or 2 percentage points is going to separate it. I mean, it was easy. I've known Jeff since high school. We graduated from high school together. I don't think there's anyone more qualified, both academically or his work experience. He's been working for the coroner forever, on both sides, that can perform the duties of that office. I mean, that is an overwhelming task, especially when you're dealing with the mental health side of the responsibilities of that office. And the poor position that the city as well as the state is in regarding those issues, I don't think there's anyone more qualified than Jeff. I think we'll be blessed to have him.
Representative Cameron Henry's been joining us 54 minutes after the hour. And Cameron, any final thoughts before we prognosticate these other races? Feel free to chime in on any of the other races coming out in New Orleans, because I know you used to represent that at one point, and see what you think. But any other things you think are coming up in the legislative session?
And also, just bear this in mind. I'm going to have to put a close on this in about 2 minutes. So appreciate you calling in, Representative Henry. And you got about 2 minutes left. Thank you.
Gentlemen, I'm happy to be on. I hope all of the listeners get involved and listen to session, follow it, not just on the newspaper, get online, and you know, you can dial in and see these sessions live and really lean on your elected officials to make sure they understand their position on bills that are coming up. I mean, that's where we need our information from. We need more citizens involved. I'll be happy to be on the show anytime. I appreciate y'all having me on. Y'all have a good night.
Thank you, Representative Henry, and God bless you, and keep up the great work we're doing. We're some of your biggest fans right here in my with my family, with my wife. She loves you, and of course myself, and of course Christopher.
And I can honestly say I'm a fan of Cameron Henry, and I ran for office against him, and I can say that. So we ran for the legislature against one another, and I heartily endorse him. So you got that on record.
All right, he said.
I appreciate it. Y'all have a good night. Thank you.
And that was heartily endorsing you, not hardly, but heartily.
I got you. Thank you, sir.
Okay, God bless you, Representative Henry. Thanks so much. Well, that was Representative Henry, Cameron Henry, who is our representative for parts of New Orleans and Jefferson Parish and St. Tammany, I believe. And great fellow, great fellow. All right, we've about time for us to go into our Chaplain Baba patriotic moment, where we just take a brief moment in time to remind you of the biblical foundations of America, of the Judeo-Christian jurisprudence of the United States of America. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, I think we ought to talk about the Supreme Court, because after all, it's the courts that end up having, they are the ones who have decided all these decisions about just how far we can have God in government. And so let us go back to the early days when the Constitution was written to try to understand what was the original intent, what was the purpose, what was the want-tos of the Founding Fathers, and how they gave us this great country, how they wrote the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. What was the motivating force behind it? So let's hear what John Jay said. He was the first Supreme Court justice. He had quite a legal career. He was the, I believe he was the president of the Yale Law School, and on and on and on. He was just a remarkable jurist. Anyway, this is what John Jay said. Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and is a duty as well as a privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. Wow. You think he wanted to kick God out of government? Well, let's go a little farther down the road here. Around the turn of the century, from the 19th into the 20th century, 1892, there was a decision in the Supreme Court. Hear what the justices thought then, some 100-plus years after the writing of the Constitution. These and many other matters which might be noticed add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation. Our laws and our institutions are emphatically Christian, and by necessity must be based upon and embody the teachings of the Redeemer of mankind. It is impossible that it should be otherwise, and in this sense and to this extent, our civilization, our institutions are emphatically Christian. Folks, they then quoted 87 precedents proving up their decision. Now, I don't know about you, but they just talked about the Redeemer of mankind. What I want to know is, do you have your Redeemer? Well, folks, this is Chaplain Hi McHenry, your host for The Founder Show. Thanks so much for tuning in. You go to my website, thefoundershow.com, find out all about us as we close with a Mont St. Martin and a Creole goodbye. God bless you out there in Allah Mamosha. Hell, Bamani Hora Siddiq, Yal Shalom.
Does this have to be the end of the night? You know I love you in the pale moonlight. I can see across a million stars when I look in your eyes. We can mosey, it's the summertime. I suppose you couldn't call it a crime if we take just a little longer to say our goodnight. They call it a Creole goodbye. we're just wasting our time. Put a minute on. There's time for a trio goodbye.
Folks, if you enjoy what you're listening to on The Founders Show, you can read more about us at thefoundersshow.net or more of Christopher Tidmore's columns at louisianaweekly.net. That's louisianaweekly.net. Read about what's going on in the Ukraine this week at louisianaweekly.net and how it might benefit Louisiana, more on the elections and all the different points, or pick up a copy of the Louisiana Weekly, available at 124 locations all across the Metro New Orleans area. And drop us an email, if you can, at christophertidmore@yahoo.com or at our foundershow.net address.